We're going to talk about parables. How many of you were here the first Sunday that we started this discussion on parables? Some of you were. I was assuming that probably some of you weren't. And so I'm going to give a very brief overview what a parable is, because some of you weren't here. Others of you may have forgotten. Repetition is a great way to learn. I need to be reminded of things over and over again. Just ask my wife. One of the things a parable is, we can call a parable is a story, okay? We can call it an extended analogy, an extended metaphor. It's an expansion on some of these figures of speech. At the end of the day, it's a story. And it's a story. It's an analogy. What's the purpose of an analogy? An analogy is used to explain something, to convince us of something. And a story, a metaphor, is not intended necessarily to do that. It's intended to make a more broad rhetorical point. Why are stories important? Why is it we hear our children at night, those of you who still have small children and who perhaps do this, why do we hear them at night at bedtime say, "Tell me a story"? They don't say, "Could you give me some facts and figures, Dad? Could you write out a pie chart of today? Could you tell me about the Dow Jones Industrial Average?" I mean, they're not going to do that. They're not going to want the figures and facts. They're going to want a story. Our minds store things in the abstract. That's the way they do it. I mean, that's the way our brains work. That's the most common way for us to do it. Now, we learn things in the concrete, but we store them in the abstract. I'm not going to get too much into this, so I don't want any eyes crossing. I get nerdy about this. I'm not going to do it. So the stories come to us as this whole idea into our head. And so when we, for instance, think the boy who cried wolf, right? You immediately have this picture of all the things that go with that. But we don't need to say, okay, point A, B, C, D, etc. It becomes this whole thing that that our brain embraces. So Jesus embraced this idea of telling stories. It's important to know that because we can try to make them something that they're not. We can try to force ideas. We can try to put our Western way of thinking as an overlay, and we have to be careful we don't do that. So we have to consider them for what they are. We have to also consider them in the context, in the time period that they were given. Learning is more than information, okay? So we have a story that teaches us something. Doesn't just give us information. It's like the difference between knowledge and wisdom. I heard somebody say one time, knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit, which it is. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. Knowledge and wisdom. You don't have facts and figures, that's one thing, but a story is this abstract idea that teaches us. One of the quotes from one of the books that Lucas loaned me, this guy says, "A parable is not a delivery system for an idea, but a house in which the reader or listener is invited to take up residence." So maybe that helps give you an idea. So we'll move on from here and get to the parable for today. Now that we have that brief background, I've chosen the parable of the talents for today. It's one of the well-known parables, and it's rather difficult and knotty at times. So I either took that as a challenge or it was just pure stupidity that I decided to take this on. I don't know which it is. Let's read through it. I'm going to read through the parable, and we'll get a general idea of it and then move on point by point. Let's set the stage here. Matthew chapter 25 is where we are. By the way, it's also in Luke chapter 19. We're going to take the Matthew 25 version of it. Matthew 25, starting in verse 14. "For it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on a journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them, and he gained 5 more talents. And In the same manner, the one who had received the two talents gained two more. But he who received one talent went away, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. Now, after a long time, the master of these slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the five talents came up and brought five more talents and said, Master, you entrusted five talents to me. See, I have gained five more talents. His master said to him, Well done, you good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Also, the one who had received the two talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted two talents to me. See, I have gained two more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received one talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed, and I was afraid. And I went and I hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, You wicked, lazy slave. You knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. And from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out that worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Happy thought. Again, these final two verses, we'll get to them, but I mean, that's part of what makes this such a difficult subject, right? We'll get to why that is, perhaps, in our day and age, and just really in any age, why that these are some hard words for us to deal with. Let's look. Let's take this bit by bit. What is this about? The book of Matthew is, the Gospel of Matthew is perhaps more than the others, other Gospels, about the kingdom. There are in the book of Matthew about 32 references to the kingdom of heaven, and there are an additional 4 references to the kingdom of God. It was all about the kingdom, kingdom living. What did that look like? What does it look like? What did it look like at the time? What does it look like now? What does it look like temporally? What does it look like eternally? And so forth. And both the Luke 19 and the Matthew 25 account, and we're in the Matthew 25 for those of you who came in just recently. Both of the accounts approach the parable from the standpoint of this imminence, this soon coming kingdom, the imminence of the kingdom. Matthew 25 begins with the parable of the 10 virgins, saying, "Be prepared." Okay, we're not going to go into that, but basically the virgins had oil for their lamps, and they were waiting on the bridegroom, and 5 of them weren't very smart, and they did not have extra oils when it came time. They didn't get to go to the party. In fact, it was a little worse than even that. And then we go into this parable of the talents. So he's talking about the kingdom. Verse 14, it is just like a man. If you have the New American Standard, Lachman Foundation, the group that did the translation years ago, has a way of putting something in the in italics, right? And basically, what it means is that's not really in the Greek, but it makes much more sense if we have it in the English. So you see, the it is just like, well, it is not in the original. Literally, it would read something like for just like a man. Okay, for just like a man going on a journey. He's saying, it is just like this. The kingdom is just like this. He had just talked about the parable of the virgins. 25:1 says, then the kingdom of heaven will be compared. Verse 14, it is just like a man going on a journey. So this is about the kingdom of God. And that was common. There's been interpretations over the years of this parable. What does it really mean? And so forth. And there's, as you... Was it last week, I think, when Lucas said there are on that particular parable, just so many options to choose from. Too many, right? It's kind of head spinning. One of the things. Some people believe that this is actually, I don't think I had read this before. Some people believe this is about an evil master. Now, if you're familiar at all with liberation theology, Danny, I'm going to call on you. When liberation theology, I mean, 40s, 50s, earlier?
I want to say 60s, 70s.
Okay, a little later than that. So liberation theology came into its own as a reaction against oppressive world regimes. That's the upshot of it, right? A theological reaction to that. It can be a very, very good thing, only as with many movements, it laid too much emphasis on that. And I say that because very likely that's the reason some people would want to interpret this as an evil master, right? It's this evil regime, you know, and heroes like Che Guevara are going to deliver us. No, he's not. So you can look at this as an evil master, but it just doesn't play out. Why? Because Jesus said this is about the kingdom. He already laid that out and said it's about the kingdom. Well, in that sense, then, the master is analogous to whom?
God,
Jesus. Okay, unless we want to fly in the face of everything that the scripture says, we're not really ready to call God or Jesus an evil master. Okay, so that's one of the reasons that just doesn't work. So we can accept the fact that this is almost, I mean, this is about the kingdom, and the master was analogous to God. Who's it addressed to? That's the next question. Who's it addressed to? If you back up, you don't have to look there, but in chapter 23, in verse 1, it says, Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples. Okay, so he's speaking to a very large group. And in chapter 23, he talks about, he gives these eight woes to the scribes and Pharisees. He reads them the riot act and says, shame on you. And then later on in verse 20, or in chapter 24, he gives these signs of his return. And in the third verse of chapter 24, it says his disciples pulled him aside privately. And they said, tell us, what are the signs going to be? So this idea of the coming, the second coming of Christ, the imminent kingdom coming, although they didn't understand it perhaps in the way we do, was still present. They said, so what are the signs going to be when you bring your kingdom? What are they going to be? And so Jesus, and the end of the age, talk to us about that, Jesus. And he did. And from then on, 24 on into where we are now, he began to give stories and parables about the kingdom and about the coming of the new age. So this is just to set, hopefully not beating a dead horse here, but just to set the background for this. This is what Jesus was talking about. All right, verse 14, getting into the story specifics here. He says, it's like a man going on a journey. What does the man do? He calls his slaves and he gives them things. He gives them talents. Now, the talent, although we could talk about it in terms of ability, in its strictest sense, was talking about money. And depending on where you look, where you do your research, yeah, it's probably 15 to 20 years worth of money, of wages. One talent. So do the math. If you're making $50,000 a day, that's somewhere between $750,000 and $1 million, right? And that's one talent. By the way, who got the one talent? I mean, you know who got the one. There was one guy, right? The unfaithful steward got the one talent. So lest we think, poor guy, he only got one talent. I'll take $750,000 any day. The guy who got 10, you know, yeah, there you go. $10 million or close to it, right? So that's what he gave them. And then, although it doesn't say this, it doesn't say, somebody brought this up to me the other day. He said, you know, it's puzzling to me because it never says, the master never said, now go do stuff. Now, Luke 19, it actually does. It says, go do business. Do business while I'm gone. However, the word entrusted, he entrusted to them. I mean, it's obvious that they were to do something with it. So we need to understand and kind of fill in the blanks that, yeah, they were expected to do it. And we know from the end of the parable that they knew what to do. I mean, the third person who didn't do anything at least knew he was supposed to, because he starts off giving an excuse, right? But we'll get to that. So as they as they're given these talents, as we look at that, it's important to think about. James and I were talking earlier, what does that mean? Is this talent an ability? Is it money? Is it a spiritual gift? What exactly is it? And I'm gonna be wimpy here and say yes. I mean, it kind of is, right? I mean, literally, this is money he's talking about. But in the larger sense of the kingdom, it's what we do in the kingdom with what we're given. And if we embrace this holistic, for lack of a better word, idea of we don't have this demarcation of secular and sacred. If we embrace this idea of everything working together, then what we do doesn't really matter so much as how well we do, right? How well we do with what we're given. But for ease of operation in the telling of the story, Jesus said they're talents, okay? Let's talk about money here. It's money. It's something they're given that they are entrusted to do something with. It belonged to the master. He's entrusting it to them, which is interesting. He didn't pull out his checkbook. Who pulls out a checkbook? I don't know. Yeah. Apple Pay. I'm not an Apple guy. What are some of those other payment?
Venmo.
I mean, I don't know. Talk to Bruce about this stuff. He's the brilliant guy on this. Yeah. Pull out your Moto payment. Yeah. So the master didn't pull that out and say, "Dude, you are the bomb. Let me just give you some money." He entrusted something to them that was his. And guess what? When it was given to the servants, whose was it still? It was the master's. It was still his. So he gave it to them. They went off and they did things with it. Two of them did anyway. All right. Verse 16 says that the guy with 10 talents immediately went off. Now, you can read too much into that and say, he was the best because he did it immediately. He had, you know, basically the guy with two was, he says, in the same manner he did this. So just a caution not to necessarily read too much into specific words, but the idea is the two faithful servants did something with what they were given, and they really didn't waste too much time about it. Okay. All right. When he returns in verse 19, we can't forget the third guy who did the dumb thing. It's easy to point fingers, right? He hid the talent. We're going to find out why. So two invested, one hid. And then after a long time, it says the master came back. We don't know what the long time was. We're not really sure how long, but it was obviously long enough for the slaves to do stuff. They had plenty of time, you know. The market could ebb and flow, and they're still making money off of it, you know. And we'll get into that in a moment, but they did what they could with what they had been given. He comes back and he settles accounts, and I want you to notice that although the reward was different in amount for the five and the two, it wasn't different proportionally. Again, maybe not to read too much into the math here, but the guy with five talents made an equal amount back. The guy with two talents made an equal amount back. They both made essentially, proportionally, the same thing. Is that important? Well, possibly. I mean, it's in other words, we don't want to say that if you've been given more, you know, you're necessarily expected to make. You're no matter what you're given, do with what you have. Do the most you can with what you have. Now, I love this. What does he tell them in verse 21, after he comes, the man with five talents comes and says, "I made five more." What's his master's response?
Well done, good and faithful servant.
It's the first part. What's the second part of what he says?
Faithful.
Yeah. So he commends him and he says, well done, enter into the joy of your master. And he says also, you've been faithful in a little, I will give you more, is the upshot of it. Okay. But what does he give him? What does he give him? I will put you in charge of many things, is the NASB. How many of you have the NIV or another version? Anything other than the NASB? Go ahead, and what does it say, Jenny?
The NIV says, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and show your master's happiness.
Okay. Put you in charge. Any other translations? Put you in charge of many things?
I will set you over much.
So it's the stewardship word again, even with the new stuff they got. So it's interesting. The master didn't say, you did wonderful stuff. Here's a killer pension plan. Go take it easy. Move to Tahiti. He didn't say, here's an incredible pay raise. Can't believe I'm doing this, man. You know, but here's a great pay raise. Or you're going to go from 2 weeks a year to 5 weeks a year of vacation. How's that? See, because our common understanding of work is just a little different. What do we work for? Well, we work for the magic 65 or whatever it might be. We work so that we will no longer have to work. When I say we, by and large, that's the American way, isn't it? That's not the biblical understanding. Now, doesn't mean we don't save up. It doesn't mean we're not to invest and be wise with our money. But the end game of work is not to not have to work. I mean, there'd be many more ways that we could go about our life if we understood that correctly. We could use the things we've been given in wonderful ways if we would understand that this is not the goal, to get there and to sit. Rest is important, but see, rest is supposed to also happen along the way, which is something also that we don't necessarily do too well. Maybe if we did that, things would fall in line a bit a bit better. All right, so we've talked about these two servants and the entering into the joy of their master. Now we get to this yucky thing. Every time I read this, I go, oh, it's like you have this onerous task that you have to do, and you've got to do it, and okay, I'll do it. Every time I read this, I don't want to watch this master say this again. I don't want to listen to him say, you wicked, evil slave, but he does. So the guy comes up to him. What's the first thing this unfaithful servant says to his master? I knew you were a hard man. That's just the upshot of it, yeah. You were a hard man. How does that differ from what the first two servants did? What did they do? What did they say? They restated what had been done. You gave me this, and guess what? I did this. You know, you told me to do something, I went and I did it. So their response to the master was to bring to him what was his and what they had made over and above that, to talk about and to present the fruits of their obedience, and to have as a result the joy of the master. The third guy, what's the thing he did? He made an observation about the character of the master. You know, you're a hard guy because you did what? What does it say? Why is he so harsh in the eyes of this third servant? You made money without working for it. Bottom line, you reaped where you didn't sow. You gathered where you scattered no seed, and I was what? I was afraid. Now you say he was spiteful. Maybe there's a little spite in it. But if he was spiteful, well, I don't know. He probably wouldn't have even brought back, you know. He would have sent some postcards from Hawaii. Exactly. Wish you were here. Not. Thanks for the mill, and you know, oh, I'll bring you pineapples. Oh. But he didn't. It wasn't the matter of hating the guy so much as being fearful. And with that in mind, it can be even more bothersome that the master responded the way he did. I'm just saying. He responded in a very harsh manner to someone who was afraid. Didn't he? If my son, well, he's just finished his freshman year, so he wouldn't be in this boat. But when he was a child, if he said, I'm scared, scared of the dark or whatever. Buck up, son, what's the matter with you? no, you know. Come on, you're gonna comfort them. So why didn't this master, when this unfaithful servant said, I was afraid, bring him in and say, give me some bro love. It's okay. It's okay. He didn't do that.
But and, I think also, I hear in the tone of the third servant, I hear foolishness too. Because if you know this man is harsh and he has gotten here through means that may even be questionable, if that's what's happening here, which is not entirely clear
right
from the context, but in his opinion at least, he believes that the master has made his money through ill gains, probably. Is that the way you would start a conversation with him?
Yeah.
And where is that probably going to get you? I mean, if you are wise and you understand how things are, you wouldn't start your conversation with that man that way. It's like talking to the Godfather, right?
Yeah.
Would you talk to your mob boss that way? Well, you know, I know that you're a very hard man.
Yeah.
I don't think you want to start the conversation with that man. You start the conversation a little bit. So I feel there's a little foolishness there here, too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there is.
He's not really understanding who he's talking to and how he should address this person. He's not setting himself up very well.
He's not. And that's a great point, because what I was going to get to is this is not the kind of fear that is a child in the dark. This is not the kind of fear that is elicited by a 12-foot, 1,600-pound grizzly bear chasing you down. Read about that the other day. Some guy in Alaska. Okay. This is not that kind of fear. It is this fear that is based on either a lack of knowledge or a lack of obedience or perhaps both. And guess what the master doesn't do? He doesn't say, no, I'm not. I don't reap where I don't, so how dare you? He doesn't say that. But again, if this is a parable about the kingdom, then we can't assign evil to the master. So we can't assume, we should not assume that the master is doing anything wrong in his business dealings. This makes sense. I mean, you don't even have to be, I'm no businessman, but I know that there are ways in which we could say that somebody made money when they really didn't do anything. Because money and investments and work have a way of begetting more money. And so in a very real sense, what he has done here has carried into other areas and down the line and kind of branched out, and perhaps there are subsidiary companies or whatever, to bring it into the modern context, that are making money and he's not doing anything. Nobody did, you know, he did this. So there's nothing nefarious about his business practices. And so he doesn't even deny that. In fact, the NIV says, it says, so you knew, ... Right? Which is one thing I like about the dynamic equivalent of the NIV. I love the NASB, but that's, so you knew this? Then why didn't you at least put it in an interest-bearing checking account? I don't know. Do something with it. what you did. You dug a hole. And then he says, take it away and give it to the man who has 10 talents. Well, this is interesting. And in Luke 19, where they use minas instead of talents, the same general idea carries. The servants say, but time out, master. You're giving his one to the guy who has the most already. Why are you doing that? And then Jesus has the rejoinder, he who does not have, it will be taken away. Okay, and we'll get to that. But first of all, why did he do that? I don't think that there was any sense of being equivalent. I don't think that God was at all about, that the servant, the master was at all about evening the score. Okay, well, okay, see, you had two, and you ended up making double that, so you got four. If I give you one, that makes five. He's got 10. Well, at least you're halfway there. I don't know. Is that okay? No, he wasn't thinking that. At some level, it's this, I would even say, almost arbitrary whim. I mean, not arbitrary, that's a really wrong word, but he didn't have to have some good excuse for doing it. Now, at the outset, we have to remember they were given what they were given according to their abilities. You know what? And here we go. There's the sticking point, isn't it? Is living life content with our abilities? I went out yesterday with a good friend of mine. We've known each other for just decades. And the two of us and my son went out to play baseball. We actually found an empty field on a Saturday in Richardson in June. What do you know? And we were playing baseball, and guess what? I don't play like I used to play, which wasn't always that great anyway. I could say, man, I can't swing a bat anymore as well as I used to. I can't throw as hard as I used to. I can't this, I can't that. Or I could say, this is fun. God's given me this. And maybe this is not really my giftedness. I don't know, I could play for the Rangers right now. Sorry. This is the, what's it? It's worth a shot. They're a farm team now, aren't they? No, I'm sorry. So whatever we have, right? I could say, okay, so I'm an actor. So I could say, man, why don't I have the chops that so-and-so has? Why can't I do that? I want to be in musicals, but I can't sing. Why can't I sing like Josh Groban or something? Why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? Juliet and I went to see Paul Simon in concert a week ago Friday, and this is a great concert, you know. I could wish all I want that I was the songwriter that Paul Simon was. Well, I never tried to be, for one thing, but no, I'm just not. Are we content with what God gives us? And the only way we can really be content with what God gives us is to focus on the joy of the master. It is the master that we need to be about, right? Not the thing. And this is just something. There's just no panacea. There's no pill. I can't tell you, you're going to take care of this now, and from tomorrow on, you'll never deal with this again. It'll always be okay with you. The love of the master will always be enough if you can just do this one thing, right? It is something we have to come back to, I think, over and over and over again. In John 21, at the end of this gospel, after the resurrection, and the disciples are sharing time with Jesus, and they're walking along, and Peter turns to Jesus, and what, do you remember this story? I know you and I have talked about this. I'm not setting it up real clearly, but do you remember what Peter says to Jesus? He points to John, and he says, what about this guy? What about him? Why? I don't know, but John was known throughout the Gospels as the disciple whom Jesus loved. In his own Gospel, he writes it that way. He writes himself in as the one whom Jesus loved. He had a tenderness toward Jesus that perhaps wasn't quite there because he was just a different guy. It was just what God gave him. Peter was a wonderful big mouth, I mean, who had these crazy things that he said and went, oh, man, sorry. But he also was the prime player on the day of Pentecost, okay? So Peter turns to Jesus and says, what about this guy? And Jesus says, What about him? If I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. And he needed that harsh lesson. He needed someone to say to him, he needed Jesus to say to him, don't worry about him. I'm going to deal with him in the way I'm going to deal with him. You're not him. Follow me. And by, it's like a bridle on a horse, right? By always going back, being turned back to the master, over and over and over, we finally get to the point where we go, that really is the best way. That's a way to do it. All right, I want to get to these last two verses, and then we're going to have maybe a little discussion about this. The two verses here that seem to be unfair, in fact, we actually hit 29, didn't we? Well, kind of. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance, but from the one who does not have, even what he does have will be taken away. The implication here is that those who do something with what they've been given are those who have. If we take it literally, you say, he who has, it's going to be taken away. James, you've got a phone. I'm going to take it away. You know, then I'm going to take somebody else's phone then. he had something, I'm going to take it away. Oh, but you don't have something, I'm going to give you something. There's no real sense in that. It doesn't follow the clear teaching of the rest of Scripture. Based on what has happened already, the clear teaching seems to be that having means doing. He who has and does something with what he has, he'll be given more. More responsibility. But he'll be given more. And the one who does not, who takes it, who sits on it, who buries it, who wastes it, it's just a life principle. It's gone. And then it gets harder. And it gets harder because he gives his talent away to the guy who has the most, and then he says, take that servant and throw him out. I don't want any part of him. Now, remember that though his audience was fairly narrow here, and he's talking to the disciples, he's talking to some others as well, he knows that these disciples are going to be going out and spreading the gospel, and they're going to be talking to people who will not accept the word of the kingdom, the gospel of the kingdom. And it seems to me that those who are equivalent to the third and unfaithful servant will be those who, as they go out and as they teach about the kingdom, refuse it. Okay? Now, let's not press the point too hard, because all of us are going to go, okay, dang, do I do enough with my one? Have I buried my one? What does burying it mean? I can play the piano, but I only took 3 years instead of four. Am I a servant who didn't do? Oh, goodness. And then we get all worried, and we've got to be careful about that. James.
I think the key to that is his view of the master and the other guy's view of the master. And it says in John, this is eternal life, that I may know God and Jesus Christ whom he sent. And the character of God, God's love and mercy and God's righteous holiness are only displayed in one place, demonstrated perfectly, and that's the cross.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the master and say he's hard, you're not looking at the cross.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a great point, James. To know was the verse you quoted again, John?
John something.
John something. To know him, right? To know Christ. To know that is eternal life. And so he's saying that those who follow the master by looking to the cross are those who you do that rather than... Yeah,
the character of God is demonstrated in the cross. His holiness, you only see it perfectly displayed in the cross. God's mercy and his love and his holiness can't... God's got to judge sin. So you see his holiness... And he does that, but he's loving and kind, and he does that by judging himself. You see God's character perfectly displayed and demonstrated in the cross. So the verse in John, to know God and Jesus Christ whom he sent, is eternal life. is when you know who Jesus is and what he did on the cross, you know God.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful, because it's so easy for us to want to simply go out and do all the mm-hmm. time. I mean, that's a tendency that we can have, and we're told to obey. But I mean, it's got to be based upon this knowledge of God. If I don't trust on an earthly level, if I don't trust my boss that I'm working for, my service is going to show. Okay, if I don't trust him, if I think if I don't understand him, if I don't communicate well, if I don't trust him, I'm not going to do the job I ought to do. If we don't know the character of God, and as we study it, we will find it is trustworthy, and he is trustworthy, then we can't obey in the way we ought. So, Janae.
Yeah, I think too, you know, with parables like we've talked about, you know, you have to kind of zoom out and not get too caught up in the
minutia.
Details.
Yeah, yeah.
And try to make it exact.
Yep.
But, you know, when you do look at this parable and you look at the same parable and Luke and put them together, and Luke, he does clearly say, put the money to work when he entrusts them with the money. And so to me, you know, I look at this third guy and what I see is he didn't obey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a failure to obey. He was focused more on whatever his viewpoint of the master. And I think for us as believers, the big walkaway I get from that third character is whatever doubts I may be experiencing in my own faith, because we do walk through our Christian life with ups and downs of doubts in our faith, I still have to stay in obedience.
Yeah.
I still have to do the thing that God has told me to do, whatever my current day-to-day viewpoint of God may be based on my circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I have to live in the obedience that God has put before me. And it's about obedience. These two guys, I do think that he immediately went out that are at once, depending on the translation. I think it is there for the purpose of showing they acted immediately in obedience. They didn't try to question or read into. And that's, to me, the big, you know, zoom out walkway of this parable for that part of it is functioning in obedience no matter what your perspective may or not be of the big picture of what you can see. Because what he's trying to do is evaluate the master and analyze and see who or what it is in this moment and judge on that. We do that sometimes as believers. We can't see the big picture of what God's doing, so we begin to question or doubt what God's doing. And oftentimes, our response is to stop obeying the basic things we've been told to do as believers. And we can't do that.
Yeah.
Another thing, to kind of tie back to what somebody else said back here, you know, talking to a mob boss, I have been in seasons of my life where my walk was awful. And I did not respect my boss because they were either unfair or didn't walk their own walk or had a lot of character flaws that I just could not deal with at the time. And so my obedience basically was weighed out on how much I respected them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I didn't respect them, then I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'll do that when I want to. So really the source of that attitude was my pride, my arrogance, my wanting to do what I felt like based on whether or not they deserved it. So when I read that verse about that third servant, I don't hear the fear talking to a mob boss. What I hear is arrogance. I look at that and see a servant who says, you're not a good man. Why should I give you anything that's going to help you? Because it's not going to help me, so why should I do that? And to me, that comes back to that obedience, is not trusting the Father who sees and has that whole picture, because my arrogance is in the way, my pride is in the way, and I don't want to work with him in spite of who this mob boss is.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
I teach ballet with lots of girls between 9 to 18, and I've got this class of 13, 14-year-old teenage girls, and I've got like 21, 22 in that class. There's always going to be a small group of kids who are going to be lazy, or they've got like 100 excuses or stories to tell me why they can't do this and why. And everybody has, you know, a certain amount of talent that they're given. You know, some have more, some have less. And I'm old school, our school is an old school, we kind of press the kids. Not everybody's gonna be a ballet dancer, that's okay. But the other day, just before the season was over, a girl was sitting crying, And I said, what's going on? And another girl said, her name is Catherine. Catherine's too scared to tell you that she has a headache because she thinks that you're going to get mad at her. And I was a little ticked off. Somebody's scared of me. Well, it's true that it's one of these lazy kids. And throughout the whole year, she hasn't done anything, right? She's always had some excuse why she needs to sit down. And of course, she's going to be scared to tell me one more time that she has another excuse. And this time, she really had a headache.
Yeah,
and that's okay.
Yeah.
So I think this third servant is kind of saying that he had a problem with a certain standard that he knew he had to meet, and he knows he didn't. And so I think that's why he's scared to tell the master. It wasn't like he was directly told by the master what to do, but he knew that he had not lived up to that standard. And to me, it's just very kind of clear, you know.
Yeah.
It's an excuse.
Yeah, and the servant said, I was afraid.
Yeah.
But how much stock do we really put in his answer?
Yeah.
I mean, you said you were afraid, but he goes on to explain, and it really doesn't sound, like I said, it doesn't really sound like fear at that point,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I got a question. I was afraid of you that you're a hard man. And then when he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, he's cast out.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like he was a hard man.
You know what? Yeah. It's a matter of. Great. That's a good question, and I'm probably not going to present a point by point answer to everything we've got here, but I think that that it comes down to the man, the servant, not accepting who the master was. He didn't accept the authority of the master. And you know what? There are times when, and I think this may be the case with children, as they learn to accept the authority of their parents, they realize, oh, they don't really hate me. They don't really, I mean, you know, most kids hopefully don't think that, but I mean, they really do want the best for me. But not until we come to that first point of accepting that this is who I am and this is who they are. Right? This is the master. There are so many ways that, try to wrap this up, but so many ways that we can understand this in the way of work, in the way of talent and ability. And the challenge I want to put forth is that we do the work that God has given us to do to the best of our ability. I mean, that's it's a simple way of putting it. Under whom he's given us. Because that's a great point. Because really, the master is, at the end of the day, God. But the temporal master is my boss, right? In certain contexts, it can be different. If you've never read Tim Keller's Every Good Endeavor, I recommend it. It's about work. It's a subtitle, Connecting Your Work to God's Work. And I'm going to read a couple of things. Ironically, they're quotes from Dorothy Sayers and not Tim Keller, but he quotes her. And Dorothy Sayers, if you don't know, you all know. So it's called, Every Good Endeavor, which, by the way, is really cool. Those of you who like jazz, at the beginning of this, he quotes, come on now. Where is it? He quotes John Coltrane. John Coltrane, liner notes to A Love Supreme, giving thanks to God for his abilities. It's really cool. But he quotes Dorothy Sayers here, and briefly give you this. She says, the habit of thinking about work as something one does to make money is so ingrained in us that we can scarcely imagine what a revolutionary change it would be to think about it instead in terms of the work done itself. I believe there is a Christian doctrine of work very closely related to the doctrines of the creative energy of God and the divine image in man. The essential modern heresy being that work is not the expression of man's creative energy in the service of society, but only something one does in order to obtain money and leisure. And then she also says this, talking about work. She says, the church's approach to an intelligent carpenter is usually confined to exhorting him to not be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very first demand that his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables. Do your work, right? Love your work. Now, if you're not in work you love, there's always a reason to search beyond that. In the context of the kingdom, we do what we do in the context of the kingdom always, always. Doesn't matter what you do. And I know many of you may be sitting there going, man, my work is not spiritual in any sense. No. There we go. We're disconnecting or separating the sacred and the secular, the temporal and the eternal in ways that we really shouldn't do. A lot more we could say about that, but one thing April and I were talking about yesterday, and I'll give this as a final example. We could talk about this so long. Any Incredibles, the Incredibles fans out there? Yeah, love the Incredibles. When's the second one come out?
June 15th.
Love that. And at the end of what, at the end of the first one, is it Syndrome? Near the end, he says, when everybody's special, nobody is. He's a resentful man, isn't he, or creature? But you know who's unhappy? At the beginning of that movie, the family's unhappy. Why? Because they aren't able to use what they're supposed to, what they've been given. They're not able to do what they're supposed to do. Use what you've been given. Find joy in the thing you've been given, right? The little boy, Dash, right? He's super duper fast. He can't stretch himself out like his mama can, Elastigirl. If you don't know it, you're going, what in the heck are you talking about? But he could complain and say, I'm not you, and I'm not you. Embrace the knowledge of the Master. Embrace getting to know Jesus, and thereby embrace what he's given you to do and who and what he's made you to be. Okay. Yeah, I wish we could keep going, but it's 11. So, any last, but I will say just briefly, any last brief exhortation?
Yeah, it's not an accident that talent in the English language implies something God-given.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was adapted. I mean, originally talent just meant a weight. And it was from the New Testament parable that the speakers of the English language decided to use that to apply to an ability. In other words, talent originally had a moral content to it, that one is responsible to be productive with one's God-given abilities.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Thanks for bringing that up.
I don't think it was... I mean, obviously a master would probably know their servants. I don't think it was a mistake that he just gave that servant one talent.
Yeah. But by the same token, he would have commended that servant had he done nothing more than what the others did.
Right. And he gave him an opportunity to do something.
Yes.
It's not like he may have known the man's character and known from the very beginning that he was probably not going to do anything with it.
Uh-huh.
But he gave him an opportunity still. There's grace there,
Yeah.
He could have known all of this from the beginning and just completely scratched him off the plan and just given everything to number one and number two.
Yep.
But he didn't do that. He actually gave that person something.
Which is really interesting. In that sense, he's a lot more gracious than we might have thought, or that the third servant certainly thought.
Remember, our God is a hard master. He is a loving God. He is also a hard master.
That's right. That's right.
We have to define it by his terms, not our terms. He wants fair and just, but he issues wrath. We see that biblically, and there will be wrath for those in the end.
Yeah.
So we have a hard master who also gives us opportunity and grace.
Yes, yes, that's right. And we can trust that regardless, we can lean into him as one who is trustworthy, knowing that he always has the best in mind for us, although we don't always understand what that is. We think the best is this, and maybe he doesn't. So.
Also, we need to always remind ourselves that hard doesn't mean evil.
No.
It's related to
something.
It's like hard and good go together.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yep, that's right. So we're all right. Don't you just wish you could go into the office now? You don't want to wait till Monday. No. All right.